Hello and welcome to Room Escape Divas. We are joined this week by the fantastic Scott Nicholson, where we join him at his gaming lab to talk about everything from Breakout EDU to the future of escape games to even Disneyland.
Oh, the rooms we have planned in a faraway place where adventures are still unknown. Where it's different from here, there's new puzzles we'll face since we've done all the ones at home. When a new room's released, we will come do our best. We will book everything in sight. But then out comes a sigh when in searching we spy a flickering, battered black light. Another black light. It curses my days. More often than not, rooms terribly fraught with lazy gameplay. Another black light, forever we're doomed. Why make it so hard? Our time is now marred with searching the room.
We have just finished four escape rooms with Scott Nicholson, who we have had the pleasure with to hang out all day. Hope you're okay with that, Scott.
Well, you know, we somehow made it. Don't call me anytime soon again, but you know, we somehow got dealt with Aunt Edna and dealt with a troubled teen and dealt with a voodoo curse and dealt with aliens.
It's crazy.
We saved the world four times yet again.
Today's going to be an exciting episode because Scott's going to tell us all sorts of things about Breakout EDU, the future of escape rooms and just analog gaming in general. And other things.
That's right. Thanks for having me on. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Scott Nicholson. I am a professor at Wilfrid Laurier University in Brantford, Ontario, where I'm the director of the Bachelor's of Fine Arts in Game Design and Development.
We are now here in Scott Nicholson's Brantford Games Network Lab, or the Begin Lab. And it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
There's a whole locked-off section for just the Begin Zone, where they have all sorts of board games and also the high-tech computers in here for gaming. It's awesome. Amanda's really excited about the PS4. It's a whole lab just dedicated for making analog games, isn't it?
Analog digital games and live-action games and games to change the world. So yeah, you're here in the Brantford Games Network Lab, or the Begin Lab, which is part of Wilfrid Laurier University's Brantford campus, which is a downtown campus. And so what we're looking at right outside is actually downtown Brantford, so that when I run events, we can open up the doors and bring people in. The students here, we just finished our first year, so we've had about 30 students finish their first year. We're going on, and we'll take about 60 students next year. So students in their 4 years here, the first year they focus on the concepts of game design and analog game design, which they actually do in this classroom, this lab we're in, because I've got a bunch of my board games here. Second year they get into doing web-based games. Third year into mobile games. And then fourth year they partner with an organization in the real world to make a game to change the world. So they all have to make games that have some sort of real-world outcome. And then they work with our Launchpad Entrepreneurship Center to see if that game they made for one organization could actually have a much larger market.
Cool.
So we're a little different from most game design programs in the world, in that we've got to focus on games for change. The students pick the organizations they want to work with, so I want to trigger their passions, whether they work with a corporation doing corporate training games or marketing games, or a nonprofit doing social good games or things like that. And the students will choose the platform, so they can choose to make a digital game or an analog game or a live action game when they're all done. We try to give them the toolkits to be designers. So it's not a programming degree, it's not an art degree, it's a design degree.
That's awesome. So what is your humble beginnings? Because I'm not too sure if you decided to start off, when I become a certain age, I want to be running a game design lab.
Well, actually, when I was growing up, I wanted to be one of two things. I either wanted to be a professor or I wanted to be a clown. So I actually got both. I think that's where I've ended up. No, my path, first degree was in math and computers, because I did the thing that I was enjoying most, which was math. I was already a gamer by that point. I grew up with an Atari 2600. I got really upset when Nintendo came up and they put two buttons on the controller because I could no longer control it.
Yes, I know. I really loved the old joystick, yes, joystick with just the red button. It was brilliant.
And I couldn't figure out then. This thing came out with two buttons. I'm like, what do I do with two buttons?
And it was great because then you could hold the base and then you could really wrench on that thing. Yep. And it was.
I like the Nintendo. I don't know what you guys are talking about.
I like joysticks.
But now buttons, you know, controllers today have, what, 27 controls on one button and you only have 10 fingers. So video game wise, I grew up with that. I grew up with Trash 80, a Terrace 80 color computer.
Oh, nice.
That had 4K of memory, and so I was learning to program BASIC on that. And I grew up playing Dungeons & Dragons and board games.
Oh, you mean
red and blue cover. Yeah. So I grew up with all that sort of stuff all the way through school. I actually grew up in rural Oklahoma on a horse farm. And so I've always been more comfortable in rural spaces, so Toronto scares me. You know, big cities scare me. So first degree in math and computers. I then became a computer guy for a while and found I didn't like my hobby being my job. Mm-hmm. We'll come back to that later. So then I went into library school and became a librarian. And so I was a reference librarian at Texas Christian University. I was still gaming at that point, and right about that point I really got involved with live-action gaming through a group called the International Fantasy Gaming Society, which were people that wore costumes and ran around the woods and beat each other with padded weapons.
Oh, yes.
AmptGuard is like that up here in Canada, but that's something that my time in LARPing actually really made me who I am now. It helped build confidence. It helped me be able to adjust to different situations. And I started designing LARPs. So back in the 80s, I was already designing live-action games. My first published game was actually Cthulhu Live.
Oh, okay.
So I'm one of the authors on the first edition of Cthulhu Live because we had come up with a combat system that didn't involve hitting each other but was still intense and live action, and so they heard this and contacted us to bring us in on that. I was also involved then through the 90s. I did my PhD in information science at the University of North Texas and did a lot of stuff with stats and data mining and then went to work for Citibank as a statistician. That was not the best fit for me, going from librarian to Citibank. So that did not – it was not ethically in a place I was comfortable, so I began searching and got hired by Syracuse University in 2001, where I began my research of libraries and data mining. So how do you make decisions about what libraries should do as far as buying books based upon the patterns of what patrons are doing?
That's kind
of
cool.
Lots of privacy issues with that,
right,
as you might guess. So that's actually what I built my tenure case around, was how do you make things that protect patrons' privacy while still getting information from them? But I was also still a gamer and had moved into board games by that time. In 1995, I actually started Board Games with Scott.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the 1995. That's too old. Let's go forward a decade. 2005. I started Board Games with Scott. So I was that was the first board game video series on YouTube.
What was your first board game? What was the first episode? What board game?
The
did
first
you choose?
Specific game was Vegas Showdown.
Oh, okay.
But I did do a Board Games 101 that ran through a whole bunch of them under giant piles of games. So I did that for 5 years, and so that was the first YouTube based series on board games, and that really I did that because I wanted to get better at making internet content. And so that led me to getting some board games published because I got to know publishers and understand how that sort of system worked. But I got to a point where there were a lot of other people making board game videos, and I felt the difference I was making was not that great. So I decided it was time to shut down Board Games with Scott and move on to some other things. At that point also, I'd seen in 2007, I saw libraries begin to use games as a way to draw people in, and I did this large-scale survey where I surveyed 400 public libraries picked at random in the U.S. and learned that about 70% of them use games in some way. And so wrote a book on this topic called Everyone Plays at the Library and began really looking at libraries and games. And then 2012, I went to MIT for a year as a visiting professor and looked at other places than libraries. So I was looking in games in museums and games in schools, things like that. Then started looking at gamification at this point, got really concerned because people were telling everyone they should use rewards for games and not just have games for the sake of games, which ties into some of the things I'm bothered with, where I see some escape rooms going with this focus on rewards instead of the focus on the play and the game. But that's a whole other diatribe. I was in Singapore in 2014 and doing some consulting with the government there and saw in every shopping mall, of which there are many shopping malls in Singapore. It's basically there's a street and every a building after building on this street is a 7-story shopping mall. Then they're all packed and it's crazy. But every one of them had an escape room facility.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah, that's kind of
every
cool.
mall. And they were calling them 4D video games and things like that. So I found some of the folks who were hosting me. I said, I'd really like to explore this. And so I did my first escape room there in Singapore. And at that point, I said, you know, I've been involved in live-action game design for decades, and there's a lot of commonalities here. Mm-hmm. And there are no scholars at this point really looking at this stuff. So just like I did with libraries in 2007, where I did a baseline study, I decided to do a baseline study with escape rooms. And that's where I put out the first survey. I had about 175 facilities respond to that survey and got some good baseline data to help us begin talking about the design of escape rooms.
And that paper is called, just for in case any enthusiast out there doesn't know what that is.
Behind a Locked Door. And so you can search for, if you go to bgnlab or bgnlab.ca, you can find a link to it pretty easily in the publications area. So that sort of brings me to where I am today, where now I'm teaching. I'm the head faculty member of this game design program and helping students to see there's more to life than video games. So get them involved with designing games of all sorts, and including these face-to-face games, as I call games beyond screens, which can involve both board games, card games, and live-action games, of which is a class in which escape rooms exist.
And the students are enjoying it?
Some are. Some are realizing that I actually make them work, mm-hmm. and that this is hard, mm-hmm. and that game design is hard to do well, and
yes.
It's very easy to do poorly.
Yes.
And hard to do well. It's easy to make a bad game.
I understand. and sometimes those are the things we talk about in the enthusiast group as well, where they think, oh, this will just be easy. Let's just throw a bunch of puzzles in a room and let them go. And then they don't understand why some of us divas get upset.
Yeah, so where I'm heading forward, a lot of what I'm doing now is trying to figure out how to use these things for educational purposes. So I made one escape room for a fort in the U.S. So it's in a military fort, and that one was designed in the 1870s. So all of the logic had to make sense in the 1870s, all of the puzzles, all of the artifacts, because it's a national park. And so everything had to fit. It had to be like, yes, this could exist. The story is a real-life story. So based off a real-life sabotage tale, and everything was made of wood. There was no timer. There was no clock. There was no anything outside of that world. So that was a fun challenge to try and make that.
Yeah, no, I bet. And I bet nobody, like 80% of the things people won't even notice. And, you know, but you can't help yourself because you want to be... I did that with the speakeasy. I wanted to make sure everything was from the 1920s, mm-hmm. right? And I know nobody else would have cared. But I just wanted to be a bit more genuine in regards to that. The only thing I couldn't do was things like speakers. They wouldn't let me hide the speakers and things like that.
And you know that you'll get the one person who will come through and notice every little thing or find the one wrong thing. Or did you have a historical advisor on that?
Yeah, so actually I ran it first with the staff of the park, the people who this is what they do every day is they reenact. And they walked in and like, that wouldn't be here, that wouldn't be here.
Oh,
that,
nice.
So before we released it, it had to pass their muster to say, yeah, this would all fit in. And so also it was run when the park was open. So after players played the game, then they went outside and then they met with, first they had debriefed by the game master, and then they met with the person, one of the people who works for the park, who then said, oh, you know that cannon you were working with in the game? It's there. You know this storehouse? It's right there. So the hope was, it was a 20-minute game mm-hmm. designed for families. So there's some interesting challenges when you know it's going to be family units coming in. It's that idea of having a lot of different very physical things, not overly taxing puzzles, but in this case, like there was hiding times where they had to hide because the guards were walking by. Mm-hmm. And I would use audio of what they would hear, the guards walking by having conversation. I want the players to hear that, so they had to hide. Well, the hiding also, it was a fun activity for kids to watch the parents hide. But more importantly, what it is it forced people to explore the room more thoroughly, because with only 20 minutes, that's not a lot of time for searching. So by having them have to hide every so often, then they would come out like, oh, I found this, because we would make sure things were in hiding places.
Nice.
It was an interesting project, and certainly one I would take on again, trying to develop within that space. But then what really caught my attention was what was going on with Breakout EDU.
Yes, Breakout EDU.
Right, so Breakout EDU, what excited me about it is first the way it was being presented as an open source platform. So the idea of Breakout EDU is it is a box, a set of locks, a black light, and a series of things. And the idea is that teachers can make games for this platform, upload the games to the Breakout EDU website, and then other teachers can download those games and play them. And so I really liked their model, what they were going with that idea of, and you don't even have to buy the Breakout kit. You can actually just, they give you the list of what to buy, the hasp that holds multiple locks, these specific locks. So teachers can get started pretty inexpensively. And then after they make their games, right now there's about 150 games that are already uploaded. They're aligned with different curricular areas and topics. One of the big challenges they're having in general is how do you take a single box and make it work for a class of 30? Mm-hmm. And that's where I try to bring in models from the Puzzle Hunt space. Mm-hmm. Because it's if you think of it as though you have three locks on a box, and if each puzzle is one lock, well, then that's not going to keep too many people busy. But if you have puzzles leading to meta puzzles, leading to a digit on a lock, you can then use a Puzzle Hunt structure to actually make that work for a large group. So a lot of what I do as a researcher in general is connect the dots across fields. That's why one of the other articles I wrote looks back to six different precursors to escape rooms. That it wasn't this one thing that just was invented and ta-da, we have an escape room. But it comes out of live action role playing. It comes out of these flash games. It comes out of adventure movies. It comes out of reality TV. And we can look back to the UK, things like Crystal Maze and Nightmare and The Adventure Game, which were game shows that were in the 80s and 90s.
Somebody, a friend of mine, just sent me a YouTube link to one of those old shows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what they are. And so it's not this brand new thing that was just birthed, that it's this combination. And the reason why it's important to look at that is because as a designer, that greatly increases your toolkit. When you know you can turn to toolkits from reality TV programming, from adventure movies, from these things, then you can make something that's much better than a series of puzzles and black lights in a room. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go out on the limb as I continue to write about this stuff and say, you know, escape rooms are not about puzzles. And I know that's going to be controversial when I make that statement.
Yes.
But I want people to think of them as something greater than puzzles. And it can be a challenge. And I know that's a controversial opinion, which is why it'll get people thinking about, maybe at least thinking about, well, how is it something greater than puzzles? How are puzzles simply the tool we're using to tell a story? And the tool using to engage people. But anyway, Breakout EDU, I've been doing some research on the Breakout EDU games that have posted. Mm-hmm. And so the challenge is right now they are at that point of just the puzzles. So they're struggling with that. Mm. But I've made a number of Breakout EDU games. I made one about Canadian electoral system. I've been making them for other sorts of teaching and training. And we did a Breakout EDU game jam here in the lab.
When was that?
In January. So it was the world's first Breakout EDU game jam.
Awesome.
We had this room was full. About half the people here were teachers and about half were game design students. Mm-hmm. So we partnered up game design students and teachers. More importantly, we streamed it on Twitch the whole time.
Oh, nice.
So we had about 20 sites around the world that were also making games at the same time.
Nice.
And so some of those games ended up going into the Breakout EDU website. And so we'll be doing another one of those game jams in the future. And so if you want to keep up with Breakout EDU, visit breakoutedu.com as a good starting place to take a look at what's going on. But if you're a teacher and you want to explore this stuff, it's a great way of bringing escape game type concepts into a classroom space.
At an affordable rate, too.
Right.
As you said, I like that fact where other people upload games. What you can do with that box, it becomes like a moddable community, I guess.
Yeah, well, they're calling it an open source platform.
Yeah.
which is an unusual way to describe it.
Yes.
But that's the idea, is you have the platform, you have the HASP, you have the locks. So I've got this one of these set up right now, and so it's basically a HASP is this metal device that allows you to hold multiple locks. Mm-hmm. And that's the one thing we don't see a lot of in escape rooms, actually. We don't see many of these HASPs. But this is the HASPs are a common part of what they do with Breakout EDU, is they'll put a series of locks on there. What I'm trying to do is encourage teachers not just to have it be classroom exercises mm-hmm. that turn into locks,
yes.
but to actually do something, because that's actually the state where educational game design was in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
Educational game design has been very bad.
Yeah.
And so in my game design classes, I actually tell students, you can't make any games where you roll a die, move a piece on a board.
Yeah.
And you can't
yeah.
make any games where you ask trivia questions off of cards.
Yes, yes.
And
Trivial Pursuit.
Yeah, and Trivial Pursuit, while a great game, was very damaging to the world of educational game design.
Mm-hmm.
And then they made digitized versions, where either you do some video game thing and then you stop and answer a question to be able to continue playing the video game.
Right.
And so this model of you get a little bit of game, and then you have to answer a question, and then the game is like the reward at that point.
Yeah.
Well, now you've ruined what the whole idea is. If you want to get people to actually learn, you have to make that learning part the reward. You're not incentivizing them with gameplay to get them to answer a trivia question. So in all my classes, the students aren't allowed to make trivia-based games. The problem I see what's Yay. Happening with Breakout EDU right now is a lot of the games are trivia-based games.
Oh, wow.
Answer the questions and head to here. And it's because we've had these decades of bad educational game design that teachers moving into the space who haven't seen good games can't get their head around how do we do something. So just like in Breakout EDU, I want the games to be more than about these trivia knowledge things. In escape rooms, I want them to be more than just the puzzles. that those are a piece to help you tell a story. Those are things you can, those are tools, but not the goal. And so I know when I put out this piece about that, I know it's going to cause lots of stink and roar, and that's good. We need that.
That'll be exciting. We can probably talk about that next.
So just so our listeners have a better idea of how Breakout EDU works, how about you describe the one that you designed?
Okay, sure. I'll spoil it. Spoilers!
So
this was called Ballot Box Bumble. And the idea, I actually made it because I wanted to get a better handle on the Canadian electoral system. So I actually made it back in October. And as I know, one of the best ways to get someone to learn about something is to have them make a game about something. So what happens in this particular game, the box itself represents a ballot box. And it has a number of locks on the outside. And so the players are, their backstory is that they have been volunteering at a poll. And the idea is that the poll director is missing, but Elections Canada is going to be calling in 20 minutes. So the players need to try and get the ballot box open to be able to report the results. And they're told that, you know, that the director, she was a little addle-brained, so she may have left some hints for herself to remind herself what the codes are for the locks so they can get them open back in her office. So the players then go back into the office, and when they get to the office, they see a number of different clue paths to explore. This one had three different puzzle paths to explore. They could find a box that was locked with they had to take a code from the number of senators and House members from Canada to get that one open. And then as they started to explore it, if they found there was a wadded-up note that was behind a trash can, and if they found the note, it would then explain that the director of this poll was actually supporting one of these parties and was going to try and defraud the election.
Oh, my gosh.
and so the advice in the letter was to say, make sure that you plant a lot of clues for your volunteers so that they will get their hands on everything related to your fraud. We will then use the video footage to frame them.
Oh.
So as the players then continue to explore the room, they learn about robocalling. They learn about gerrymandering and redistricting. They learn about first past the post and proportional representation. And in each case, as they explore the information that was left behind, they then have to solve a challenge to show that they understand that, and that challenge helps them unlock the locks to get the box open. They get the box open, there's ballots to count, and then at that point, Elections Canada calls. Then the players are asked, well, what did you find? And the players can then tell them the results from the election, or they can tell them there's some fraud going on. And the way that the team wins the game is by reporting fraud. So unlike most puzzle games, you know, the goal of that game, if you can get the box open, you can count the votes. But if you don't report the fraud, you don't win. It's a role-playing ending. And so you could actually win the game as soon as you discover the first piece of fraud. You could say, hey, I'm going to call Elections Canada now and report it. And your team wins. So there were three different endings, three different newspaper articles based upon whether the team didn't get the box open and didn't have anything to say, whether they just reported the results, in which case they are then framed for being the ones that frauded the election because they have the video footage of them looking at the robocall records and playing the audio, or if they actually reported what was going on. So those are three endings, but all of that ties into this standard Breakout EDU box. So each lock is a lock that comes with the box. The USB key comes with the box, and so a teacher can download it all and run it in their classroom.
I really wish that I had been taught about Elections Canada that way.
Me too. Seriously, that sounds awesome.
I think two of the words that you threw out there are words that I'm not familiar with. It's probably because I didn't have a Breakout EDU to teach me.
Well, and I also think that shows where I'm heading with design, how this is not about the puzzles. Mm-hmm. That the puzzles happen to be these stepping stones. But in this game, it was really about getting the players to recognize that when they're volunteers, that they have a responsibility. And that if they see something, because this is designed for grade 10 kids.
Okay.
And so it's this idea that if you see something and you're in this kind of a role, you should say something. That is what you should do, not just do what you're told. And in this particular game, if you follow the normal escape room tropes, get the box open, do the thing you think you need to know to win the game, you actually have the worst ending. You lose the game. And so that's what I look for in not only doing these breakout designs, but in other sorts of designs. How do you put the players in a role that forces them to think about who they're supposed to be? Not just this external person who happens to be in a location having to solve a bunch of puzzles.
I think I found that when designing puzzles, when you design something like that, the role-playing element, where they have to think outside of, let's solve this puzzle, then people get confused by all of a sudden, wait, what? Why would we do that? Well, no, if you just read, we told you, kind of thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of fun seeing them struggle.
Yeah, there was... at the wedding event, especially when people did exactly as they were told from beginning to end, they would lose.
Well, we could actually predict this too, though. So I do research about motivation and intrinsic motivation and extrinsic motivation. And so the research that I do is there's a fellow, Daniel Pink, wrote a book called Drive.
Yes.
And there's a great video. If you just do nothing else, go search on YouTube for Daniel Pink and Drive. There's about a 10-minute video which will explore this. And what they found, and what we found, and we found this again and again, Alfie Cohn wrote a book called Punished by Rewards, which is about parenting and grades and the problems with grades. And all this points to one of the findings is that when you have a reward, you limit people's creativity and you limit their intrinsic motivation. And so we see this in escape rooms, and we see this in this room design. When you present, and I played with this particular game, when you present the reward, and in this case the reward is crack the locks, open the box, get your thing, people then shut off their creative spaces. And we know this. We can predict that because if people get focused on the reward, their ability to be creative goes down. So that's why I want to push this thing forward about saying, you know, escape rooms are not about the puzzles. Because the puzzles are that path of do puzzles get reward. And if we can get people to get away from that a little bit, there was a post in the enthusiast group recently about someone who was talking about, can't we just explore it for the story, explore it for the experience, without that ticking clock, without that leaderboard, without that temptation of the rewards, we're creating these experiences where players do shut off all that creativity and get focused so much on the puzzles and on that path. Mm-hmm. So I know it's going to be a very long time before I'm going to be able to get there, but we can. I point to where escape rooms are today in a design structure back to where video games were in the 1980s.
Yes.
1980s video games were about a few simple mechanisms, earning as much points as you can. There wasn't a lot else. I'm engaging with the mechanisms. I'm engaging with jumping and shooting because I get points, but bad guys explode into numbers. And in gamification, so I studied that, there were a lot of people that weren't gamers, and they made gamification look like video games from the 1980s. You do your points, you get your badges, you get your rewards because things turn into numbers. We see that right now with escape rooms, that we have these series of puzzles. And as you accomplish the puzzles, then they either turn into numbers because it's a scoreboard, or they turn into time, which is the scoreboard. Mm-hmm. And so that's we're at that point. Gamers today, most games, if I asked you, what was the score you got on the last game you played? With everything except for sort of those casual browser games or games that are based on, you know, this, most gamers don't know. It's like, was there a score? If I even ask that question, think about the game that you've been playing. Is there a score running in the top corner? It's, you have to think about it.
The most popular game for children right now is
Minecraft.
Minecraft.
Yeah. And is there a score for Minecraft?
No.
No.
So The gaming world, and a lot of gamers have moved to that point where they're playing the game because they're exploring a story, they're becoming awesome, they're doing something, they're creating something. And I've got actually a paper out there on meaningful gamification, which goes through six things that you can use that aren't points and rewards. And we can move the escape room feel to that space. And that's why I think it can happen. It's got a ways to go, and it's got to have people recognize where we are now. But we've seen this path before. And how can we begin to carve a path where we see these puzzles as just like we see jumping and shooting now in video games? Jumping and shooting are something, they're tools, but I'm not going to play this game because of the jumping and the shooting, you know, but I'm doing it because of other things. I've been playing Battleborn as a most recent example. Battleborn has jumping and shooting, but it has larger scale things you're trying to do, and those jumping and shooting things are heading you towards that path.
So with video games, for instance, you know, that took the medium maybe about 15 to 20 years to really experiment with how you can tell a story differently with a video game than with say a movie or whatever else. Where do you think, like, how long do you think escape rooms might, do you think that's going to be a similar thing? Do you think they're going to be around long enough to do that?
You know, we're hitting in North America now, we're heading into the bubble. Of where Asia was a few years ago, where Europe is sort of in now. We're heading into that now where we're seeing some towns that are becoming oversaturated. So we're going to see, again, a continued growth for a while, and then we'll see that collapse. And some of the things they'll collapse too, I think we're going to see some specialties. So you're going to have your point-based games, the games that are about for the performers. You know, we want to knock out the puzzles, we want to get the score, we want to get the points. You're going to have games that really refine towards that goal, like the Bodeborg in Boston, which has just hit Boston. It's really about, for those of you that don't know, so this is a video game style escape room space. So you go in as a team. It's almost like Wario World, you know, that it's mini, it's rooms that are mini games. You're not told what you have to do, but your group has to figure out what to do and accomplish it in a very short period of time. If you don't accomplish it in time, then you fail, you leave, and then you can start the whole game over. And each game will be five or six of these rooms. So you go in as a group, but it's very physical, it's very point-based, that sort of. So I see one path going towards a hardcore, go-for-the-score, that sort of action video game model.
Like an obstacle course, but with video game.
Right.
And, yeah.
Right. And so the nice thing about that is they're a little bit more replayable.
Yes.
You know, it's that difference between tasks and puzzles. Rooms that have more tasks are more replayable rooms, mm-hmm. where it's like, I'll tell you what you need to do. Your job is to pull it off. Mm-hmm. And then you can refine your skill. Kind of like a good heist room
mm-hmm.
can be more of a task-based room, one that can be enjoyed to be repeated because you're trying to perform better. So I see that happening. I see that path. And that's really bringing in sports.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where you're getting into that the mind sports sort of concept. And then the other path I think we'll see much more develop is that integration with theater, that mm-hmm. integration of storytelling, where we get away from the reward and you are just in a space exploring this story. It's kind of like Then She Fell, which is New York theater, and Sleep No More.
Oh, right.
And so these are both freeform theater projects where you get to explore. So Sleep No More, 300 people in a five-story building in New York City, exploring for 3 hours this space and seeing what parts of the story they want to see. It has a very escape room-like feel to it, actually. And there are some mental challenges. You know, there's a maze in there. There are things that can actually happen to you. But there's not this score. You're not presented with a reward. It's about find the story that's fits for you. I think Heavy Rain on the PlayStation 4. Did you play that?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so let's talk about that. I think Heavy Rain, as an example of where escape rooms could go that aren't reward-focused.
Yes.
So, because what made Heavy Rain interesting and what I found about it when I played it was a freeing of my normal, I need to get the best ending, because it didn't allow you to.
No, and not only that, it didn't, it allowed for saves, but at the same time, like, if you had a character die, they stayed dead.
They were dead.
And you just didn't get that
story
anymore.
Right. So you, and there's a freedom that comes with when you accept, I'm going to engage with this world and see what happens and see how it plays out.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see an interesting path of escape room futures, whatever it becomes, be these narrative spaces where we're going to go in and explore this narrative path. And it could be that there's many different paths that you could explore. And again, that could hit the replayability thing.
Mm-hmm.
Is that I know in this game we want to take this path. Now, it means as designers, you have to design more than what everyone will see. But that's what we do in games anyway. In game design, you design a lot more than any one player sees.
A similar game to that, to Heavy Rain, that kind of improved on that model was Until Dawn, which mm-hmm. came out recently.
Yeah.
Which, again, there isn't really a good ending because it's a horror movie that you're doing. So it's much the same way. It's that there's branching paths. And we played it about two or three times to try and explore everything that could have happened.
Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting model for escape rooms. Mm-hmm. That when you go in, you know there's a rich enough story here that's going to engage you, that you want to come and pay your $25 multiple times to see how it ends, which, again, is a theater model. When you have mm-hmm. some theater shows, that Sheer Madness, you know, has been playing for a long time, which is a whodunit type thing, and the audience votes on an ending and has different endings. But I think this is, again, the advantage of not getting stuck on my escape room needs to look like escape rooms, because escape rooms look like escape rooms.
Right.
But rather, hey, what's going on with this game-based storytelling? What's going on with what's on consoles? What's going on way outside of all of this? How do we get people to engage? How do we get – and I think a lot of my research always comes back to the concept of play. How do we get players to be playful and not puzzle-solving machines that are there to break out of the room? And part of play – and I've been using this in my board game design. An important part of play is power. That you're giving responsibility to the players. You're giving them some control over what's going on. They need to feel they have that control to make the story change, to make choices. They have to matter, which is my number one thing when I talk about game design, escape game design. Make the players matter. But in this case, even empowering them to go further, making their choices matter. And yes, it means you have to design more than what any one team will see, but that's how you're going to get people to come back and play the games. So this is going to be 5, 10, 15 years in the future.
Someone might be hearing it
right now and say, that's what I'm going to do.
I've even noticed that puzzle-wise, games escape games are becoming simpler puzzle-wise because they want to become more mainstream, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're going to, and or more task-based as well. So if they are realizing that it's become, they want to make it more experiential and immersive that way. And so the puzzles sort of get made easier. And that's not a bad thing. If for us that likes puzzles, then you know, we have to go elsewhere. But I do also like an immersive experience within an escape room.
Have you guys done Five Wits?
No, none of us have.
So Five Wits, I'd highly recommend if you're near Five Wits location, they are growing, because they have been out since 2003 and are still financially viable. Right. And their puzzles are very simple, but there's more tasks. It's very directed. They've thought about throughput. They've thought about control. It is a different route for the future of escape rooms, and that's the theme park route.
Mm-hmm.
That it becomes, and Disney has actually been playing a lot with puzzle-based challenges in their parks. I don't know if you know this, but the next time you are in Disney World, in the Pirates of the Caribbean, right around there in Adventureland, there's a whole Pirates Challenge game that you can play. There's five different versions. You can pick up a map. You have to make choices where to go. You'll tag in at different locations, and the space will change based upon what you're doing.
Oh, that's neat.
You don't know. You've never heard of that. Most people have no idea that exists. Epcot has one that's a bit better known. That's now Agent P's Adventure, where you go into one of the world showcases and go through a series of challenges. So they're taking the sets they have and turning games into this open space. So someone sees you going up to a statue and holding up a little coin, and all of a sudden the statue comes to life and starts talking with you.
You want to do it, right.
And you go up and say, what are you doing? And you're like, oh, go over to that booth. And that's how you get started. They don't have to market it.
Okay.
And that's a totally different take on these sorts of live-action experiences.
Yes. And Disney is great for immersion and experience. Like, if I can understand why the theme park people would take a hold of escape rooms, because they got the set and decor. I mean, all of the rides at Disney, even from long ago, are crazy immersive.
And and important, as we talked about earlier, they have an underlying consistent narrative.
Yes.
So escape room designers out there, even if you don't tell your players about that narrative, have the narrative. Have a consistent narrative that makes sense, that you build everything to. And my other piece of advice is tell the players. Give them the choice, at least. Even if you don't force it down their throat. Give them the diary. Give them the ability. And so Sleep No More does this very well in New York. Has anyone been there, Sleep No More?
No.
If you're in New York City, it's definitely worth doing. So in Sleep No More, you put on a mask and you are allowed to explore this 5-story old hotel. And there's actors that are doing a play throughout. And you can follow an actor. You can stay in a space. If you want to stay in the bedroom and the bath and watch those scenes all day, you can do that. If you want to go to the candy store and eat candy out of the jars, you can do that. If you want to go into a secretary's office where there's diaries everywhere, you could spend 3 hours doing nothing but reading the stories. And so they've designed it to get you to play multiple times, because you can't do all of this. But they've made it so that different sorts of players can find something they want to engage with. I called it players, even though it's theater. It's it's really blending this game and play space. But it's certainly worth exploring for looking at other directions where this sort of immersive theater / escape room / puzzle / mind games can go.
There's a similar thing happening this summer in Toronto called Hogtown, I think.
Okay.
And it's based on the, I think, 1922 Toronto mayoral election. Same thing in a big building, and you follow what characters you want. And I think there was another one that was done before called Tamara that was years and years and years ago, but it became famous in Vegas after a while.
It will be interesting to see what the impact that in America that the haunt industry has back on our escape room world.
Mm-hmm.
We see a little of that up in Canada, not so much because the haunt industry isn't quite so big here. But as on one of your previous episodes, talking about haunts. But it'll be interesting to see, because we're seeing where there's a heavy haunt environment. We are seeing more of this immersive space, more of this storytelling. Because if you think about what a haunted house is, it is nothing but the immersion.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so it is telling a story. And again, what they do well is they have a consistent backstory. Even if all you are doing is jumping because the scary guy came out at you, the reality is there's an immersive backstory. And just like I can say escape rooms are more than puzzles, haunts are more than people jumping out at you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a good haunt is about something deeper than that. Even if it's just giving that participant the choice to engage in the story. And that's why I'm very frustrated when I go into an escape room today and they give you no story at all. Yeah. And they're like, there you go. And it's like, you're not even giving me the option to be able to immerse myself in this. It's not even a choice you're offering me. So I was doing one room and got very frustrated. And afterwards I said, well, what was this connected to that? And they had a story. I'm like, why didn't you tell me? Why didn't you tell me that was going on? I would have, you know, so it give the players that ability to learn about what's happening.
Or discover it.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you think it's a matter of like giving that blurb at the beginning or putting enough in the room that they can discover it for themselves?
The starting blurb can be useful because mm-hmm. it can help you at least understand some basics of where you are. And then I think both are useful. If you think about video games, so again, using a video game model because they've had some time to develop. Video games now immerse you with, sometimes there's a pre-movie, sometimes there isn't, and the tutorial is woven in with the backstory. Escape rooms could do this by weaving in their spiel about the beginning of the game with your backstory.
This is how directional hook works. Let's hear it again.
But that could be actually built in, yes. Just like in video games. Okay, here's the tutorial about jumping. Some games weave in the story pieces. So as you're getting those basics, you're learning those things about not moving furniture. Well, that could actually be, as a child, this happened in the world and someone was crushed by falling things and therefore you don't move. You could weave that in together so that mm-hmm. that would be one path. Or there's the board game path where that here is a set of rules, you read the rules, and then you play the game. Mm-hmm. And that's actually how it is right now, is there's that pre-game set of rules. Where we'll go, I don't know. Yeah. But there's some interesting things to think about, is how do we make it so that it's not, here, read this paragraph, but so it's a little bit more immersive.
No rules, actually. I'm quite happy if we don't get rules on how to do an escape room. Because we did once, if you remember, off in Mississauga. It was this book. And then it had multiple pages.
Oh, no.
It was awful. Because we had to like, what? Because the rules weren't even really well written out. And so we had to jump back and forth between pages to figure out, why are they telling us this? And then you read on page 5, oh, that's why they told us that on page 1. It was awful. It was horrible. It was so confusing. We don't like rules. Anyway, sorry. If you can immerse yourself, have the game immerse you into it some way so you understand how the game works, that'd be nice.
That's one arrow ranted.
Yeah.
And 5Wits does a cool thing like this, is that you have a pre-video, and where you are standing watching video is actually where the first puzzle is. And the game, the facilitator who gets you to watch the video, then he kind of just leaves you. And your first learning the rules is actually figuring out how to get into the game. Hmm. And then each one's different, but each one gets you. And the idea is that, and this was a design goal, is to create a transition point for the players, mm-hmm. to create a pathway where the players make that turn from here am I in the real world to here's this role in the game. I think the Ohm Escape actually does a nice job with this because they do a series of things to transition you into game space. They blindfold you, mm-hmm. so then you're taken out of your space. But you still are walking in. They're still giving you instructions on how to do. You then enter a physical space. You can tell something is different. Then you have music. There's an audio track, and that begins to play. They haven't played much with smell in general. They could. So this would be the idea of engage player senses one at a time, mm-hmm. to slowly take them from where they are in outside world to where they are in game world. Then you're still there with your eyes closed, and you learn about your backstory. Not long, but enough. And then you begin right away, you're able to flesh out that backstory with the first chamber. And if you think about each of their rooms, this is what they usually mm-hmm. do, is there's something right away that helps you flesh out that story and helps you better understand what's going on before then it immerses you into puzzles. So I think they did a good job of taking you on that path from you are a normal person to you are in this state.
A little bit off topic. The very first time I had the sense of smell used for a game, it would have been actually at Epcot Center. Mm-hmm. And when you are going on the ride, I think it was the Imagination. Yeah, right? Yep. And then you see, they take you back to the past where there were dinosaurs and they had these animatronic dinosaurs. And it wasn't the dinosaurs that was really cool, although it was. It was the smell, because suddenly it smelled like you were in a really nasty jungle. And it was very stinky, but it was... But it immersed you even more. It's like, oh, wow. And I had never experienced that before. And I thought, oh, this is really cool. They did such a great job there. And when they had their shows, I remember one time I don't know if you saw the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids show, and I don't want to give too many spoilers, but they involved more senses than sight and sound, mm-hmm. and it shocked me, and it was really cool. So it's like, okay, I'll give you one spoiler. So you've seen it, right?
Oh, yeah.
So they blew up the dog, and so he becomes really huge, and then he comes out, and it's a 3D show, and he comes out of the curtains, and then he sneezes, and then a spray of water hits you in the face.
Are you sure it's water?
Well, I hope so.
Actually, also off topic, like, same at Disney, I went on the Alien ride or whatever it was.
Did somebody probe you?
Huh?
Ow!
No, it freaked me out, though, because same
the probing! Ow!
I'm editing this out.
No!
No, but they had the Alien at one point breathe on you, and I was freaking out. I was
strapped down.
So like, and you hear it above you, and then there's like little sprays, and it's
So that was too intense. They ended up making a new version of that based around Stitch, is kind of in the Disney podcasting world. that ride is kind of known as the worst ride in all of Disney World.
Because
what
they did
with Stitch, so it was really scary.
Yeah.
Then they made it a little less scary. But they still do all the stuff to you. They strap you down. They blow stuff at you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, it was Journey to Imagination when I went to Epcot Center as a kid. That was, for me, an incredibly inspirational ride.
Mm-hmm.
That the character, the Dreamfinder character, the idea of taking dreams and bottling them up, that actually led me towards those multiple paths of professor and clown. And even today, you know, I still have Figment is up in my lab here. That's the Dreamfinder concept.
Yep. Where?
So right behind the glass there.
Oh, there he is.
Figment.
That's a purple dragon. Yep. If you've ever, that's kind of cool.
That was an inspiration to sort of what I do today. In fact, I wrote the folks that put this ride together, the Journey to Imagination, to say, you know, here's a picture when I was 8 or whatever at this place and meeting Dreamfinder and meeting this, and here's what it's turned into today. I got a very nice letter back saying, you know, well, it's neat to see you've become a live version of what we were trying to craft in that ride, that idea of the importance of imagination and play and how you can, in my case, what's been interesting is now I'm helping other people find that magic. Mm-hmm. Now that I'm leading a group of undergrads who are going through this 4-year process, where I'm trying to transform them on how do they take their concepts of inspiration and play and use it to make a difference out there in the world.
Hmm. Cool.
So that sort of leads into how has your first year gone?
So it's been a lot of changes. You know, moving to Canada from the U.S. has been interesting, and directing a program in a smaller school, coming from a large Syracuse University, coming to a smaller school. So it's really that big fish, little pond. The nice thing is I have my fingers in a lot of things. They've got housing here, so I'm involved with housing, involved with community events, involved much more broadly than I was when working for a larger academic department where I was in this small piece. So that's been nice. We've got some big things bubbling, and so you can keep up at beginlab.ca. You can keep up with what's going on there. But things I can't announce. We have lawyers talking to lawyers. But there will be some pretty cool things around concepts of escapes and different applications of escape games. And so it's exciting to see that engagement. And it's good I'm in Toronto for that, because Toronto is the hub in North America of escape games, so there's a lot of people interested to see what's going on with that.
And tons of enthusiasts, too. There you go.
You can't shake a stick without hitting an enthusiast.
No.
But that's okay, because they signed a waiver.
And we're done!
Thanks, Scott, for joining us!
Well, thank you for having me. If you want to keep up with what I'm up to, you can head over to S. Nicholson on Twitter or on YouTube, Facebook. You can find me at Professor Scott Nicholson. And come join the Escape Room Enthusiasts group on Facebook. And don't forget, anytime you see a black light, it's time to do the black light dance!
Another black light!
Room Escape Divas is hosted by Inverse Genius. You can visit InverseGenius.com to find all sorts of other awesome geeky media, including podcasts like this one. You can also find us on Facebook. Just look up Room Escape Divas and subscribe to the page. And if you are using Twitter, feel free to use the hashtag REDivas when mentioning our podcast. Thanks again for listening, guys, and we will see you next week.